Hello, everyone, and welcome back to the 16mm Film Crew. I'm Cindy.
And I'm Dale.
You can watch us on YouTube. You can like and comment on our YouTube videos and subscribe to our YouTube channel. You can support us on Anchor. You can listen to us everywhere podcasts are found at 16mm Film Crew Podcast. Leave us a rate and review. And visit us on our website at www.16mmfilmcrew.com. So this week we watched Priscilla. Here is your synopsis. When teenager Priscilla meets Elvis Presley at a party, the man who's already a meteoric rock and roll superstar becomes someone entirely unexpected in private moments. A thrilling crush, an ally in loneliness, and a gentle best friend. This movie stars Kaylee Spaney and Jacob Elordi, and it's directed by Sofia Coppola. So, Dale, thoughts?
I think this was a very beautiful picture. It just goes on to highlight Sofia Coppola's immense talent as a director. And the career she established outside of her father's shadow. But yeah, beautiful, like, wonderful, wonderful movie. That's my brief version. I don't want to say too much right now.
It's very brief, yes. Okay. Yeah, okay. So, my thoughts on this movie, I felt this movie is very scary. Like, which I guess if you're gonna flip the story where you're looking at it from Priscilla's point of view rather than Elvis's, like, I guess it definitely is gonna be scary because as most of us know who like knows the history of that situation, Priscilla was a literal child. She was 14 years old when they met and started going out. He was 24, I believe, a grown man. And like, at first, you're like, okay, the child bride thing is gross and, like, very scary. But there, like, the more the movie goes on, you realize, like, oh, the age difference was just, like, one of the things out of the million of other things that were just utterly disturbing. Like, I was very uncomfortable throughout the entire movie. Like, just, I felt like I was holding my breath the entire time because I was just like, oh, this is so gross and uncomfortable. And please, please get out of this house. Please leave. Like, it really is like watching a horror movie when you like, you know, somebody's about to get killed and you're like shouting at the screen, like, what are you doing? Like, you're about to get murdered. And that is kind of how I felt watching this. I was like, I know how the story goes because, you know, history, but like, while you're watching it, you really feel like it might, like, things might really go south for her. So.
Yeah, this is, I will say, the performances of Kaylee and Jacob Elordi were wonderful. You know, of course, Kaylee, you know, her portrayal of Priscilla as Priscilla's evolving from a young girl into a woman and finding her own voice and identity. Wonderful. And I think it was aided by the fact that not only is this based on a memoir from Priscilla, it was also aided in the fact that Priscilla was also there as an executive producer. So I think what I like best about this movie is it does not. And here's the thing we have to realize with celebrities and historical figures, they're regular people too. We don't know their skeletons or their demons or issues they're dealing with. And that's also why I kind of find Jacob's portrayal of Elvis probably a bit more realistic than Austin Butler's one, particularly when you're dealing with an actual family member who actually knew Elvis at that time. I feel like Austin Butler's portrayal of Elvis was the later stage of what we saw in the movie. You know, when people think of Elvis, they think jumpsuit and cape Elvis when he's near the end of his career and he's high on Vicodin and all the kind of drugs. And that's, to me, that's the one Austin Butler played throughout his whole life. Like, in wrestling, there's a term where you create a character, your character personality is just you cranked up to 11 or 12. I feel like that's the one. Like, we didn't get the normal Elvis. We got the showman Elvis 24/7 with Austin Butler's. And as far as Sofia Coppola, like, once I said, this is like a beautiful picture. like the wardrobe, the hair and makeup, like Haley's wardrobe and makeup was like perfect and spot on. Like they had her looking really, really, really nice in this movie. But Sophia is her specialty. Somebody said she makes a lot of trapped princess movies, and they're trying to do it as a knock. I don't see it as a knock. There are plenty of directors who stick within their wheelhouse. Like, nobody complains about George Lucas doing purely sci-fi and dabble in adventure serials, him and Spielberg. Like, every director has their wheelhouse, and I feel like the perception of Sophia doing tortured princess or trapped princess pictures is because I think you usually gravitate to content and stuff that you can relate to on a personal level. And I think that's why she excels at this project, because remember, she's a daughter of one of the most famous film directors of all time, even though she's like one of the best filmmakers in her own right. So she can kind of relate to the characters that she's, you know, telling the story of, you know, Priscilla, you know, the virgin suicides, you know, Marie Antoinette. Like, so, and I love that, because that's not really a portrayal that we get in the industry as far as that perspective of women and how they deal with these kind of situations, you know.
I don't know. I feel like I think she's good at doing this kind of like sad white girl thing, like, because that's her life. Maybe, yeah. I don't know. She seems pretty happy in her own life, but you know, maybe just in terms of like the historical characters she gravitates towards, I feel like maybe that's just something that she might relate to, but I don't know. I feel like in terms of like, it's complicated for me when it comes to these kinds of, when it's like, I have a thing that I do and I'm just going to do that.
Yeah.
Like, especially when women are directing, because like Greta kind of does the same thing. Like, it's not like sad white girl, but it's just like difficult white woman, like that difficult, quirky white woman. Like, that's Greta's thing. But like,
yeah.
I feel like there's a reason why I gravitate towards Greta's work more than Sophia's. And I don't know why, because like, first of all, I love Marie Antoinette. It's one of my favorite movies ever. But like, I think there's just something, I think, you know what it is? And I feel like we talked about this when we reviewed The Virgin Suicides a few months ago, where it's like dialogue.
Yeah.
Sophia doesn't have a lot of dialogue in her movies, and that's very intentional. Like, she yeah. makes sure that the dialogue is sparse because she wants you to feel everything the character's feeling just by their body language, just by their facial expressions, you know, and the situation presented. And I feel like there's definitely a space for that. And I actually like that. In certain points, I actually like that in this movie too, because the situation is so crazy that like you don't even need a lot to explain why it's so unsettling. But when you have a very dialogue loving woman, that's those are the movies I'm gonna go towards, where it's a lot of talking, and because for me words equal like substantive, like meaty things I can grab onto. Not that that's necessarily true, but it's just, that's how my brain processes it.
Yeah.
So, but going back to the film, I feel like this movie actually was kind of toned down in terms of like how aesthetically pleasing her films usually are. Like, yes, you still have fabulous wardrobe. You still have amazing makeup and hair. Like, Kaylee was dressed down. She was eating like, in every scene. But in terms of like highly stylized things, I don't know if I really felt like the punch of that. Like, I remember like when I was watching The Virgin Suicides being like, I kind of know exactly who these people are just based off of like what their rooms looked like and yeah. how they carried themselves. And again, it's so funny that we reviewed that and we're reviewing this, because like there is a thing that she does where she kind of holds the audience at kind of arm's length sometimes. But I feel like in this one it was a little different, where it's like most of the scenes kind of took place at Elvis's house. Like, you were in yeah. his house the majority of the time, you were in his bedroom the majority of the time, and so you got a like an oddly close look at these people in a way that I don't know Sophia has ever done that before. Like, I don't know if we've ever been this close to the characters. which it's really cool because I feel like I really got to know these people. And again, it's from Priscilla's perspective. Like, obviously, we're not going to know everything. But like you were saying, this felt much more like an accurate portrayal of like how Elvis probably was in real life versus, and I watched Elvis. So like, I know that like, they didn't go as deep with his like, I don't know, mental state until the late stages in this late set, like in the early 70s.
Yeah.
When he's like on his way to death because they're trying to cover, because they're covering so much ground of like his actual career. So like you're not, Priscilla was in it, but not even really that much. Like the movie is about Elvis. Like it's squarely positioned on his perspective. This isn't. Yeah. So you get to kind of see a little bit more. And I mean, is Jacob kind of just doing Nate Jacobs, but like in Elvis voice? I don't know.
Probably, but
kind of.
Yeah.
But I will say that Miss Kaylee Ate Down, like her performance was fantastic. Like she killed that joint. So, hey, I'm not going to complain about it too much because I feel like he did what the script was requiring of him. Like, not to play necessarily the villain, but maybe the anti-hero. What's a nice way to say like evil man? but you can understand where he's coming from if you understand the historical context.
How do you say that? I wouldn't say, what's the word I'm looking for? See, I don't like these words. Like, I know protagonist is the sole lead character. Mm-hmm. And I think it's dual protagonist. I know it begins with a D, and no, it's not duo, but like he's a secondary protagonist in a way because he, through the course of this movie, you see him trying to find, like, he is aware he has an anger problem. He's aware that he is also a very much a philanderer or a cheater, but you also see him wrestling with the issues of, his father controlling his career, general, as what she calls him. And also, he's also wrestling with, he's trying to find something. Like, he's reading the Bible, even though he's using it to also pick up chicks. Then when the book burning happens, you know, he's doing meditative stuff. He's doing, like Aaron Rodgers and doing ayahuasca and shit. He's reading yoga. He's looking for something to fill something he does not have. So he's like a really, he's not 100%, but he's very much also a sympathetic villain because you could see as to what's going on, as to why he behaves the way he does.
Yeah, I feel like, this man. Yeah, he made me viscerally angry. I think I was like stewing in my seat. Like the theater I was at, people were laughing a lot because there are like some unintentionally funny moments in this, but like I was so mad. I was mad for several reasons. One of the reasons I was angry was that I don't know. I feel like I was kind of mad at her parents. I feel like they didn't do enough to protect her from being in that situation. I mean, yeah, sure, your kid is going to be like, I'm going to run away. But mind you, they're in Germany and he is in Tennessee. Like he could technically just like go and get her, but like that'd be kidnapping. So I don't know the rules back in the 40s or 50s. So I don't know if he would have been able to get away with it. But what I do know is like, as the parents in your 16-year-old or 18-year-old, because that's 14. When she basically left. Huh?
14 when they got together.
Yeah. And no, which is true, which is like, how did they?
There was like a 10-year difference. She was 14, he was 24.
Yes. The way that they try to explain it, which I guess is practically what happened, I'm sure that's what happened in real life, is that like she would go to his house, but there were like adults who the dad knew from the army who was like, no, she'll be chaperoned all night. But as soon as they rolled up to the house, the chaperones left and like they were left to their own devices. So like she wasn't being chaperoned or looked after. And what I'm saying, like when she actually left the house, like they shouldn't have let her go to Tennessee either, like just on a vacation. But when they were like, we're going to put her in school here and don't worry, she's going to be chaperoned by my folks. Like, what are you talking about? Like, this girl is not leaving this house. Like, she's still underage. Like, once you're 18, like, that's, you know, you're an adult. You can kind of, the parents don't have any control over that. But, like, she was still 17 when she left her house and, like, her parents let her go. So I was mad at the parents. And then I was mad at the people at his house because they didn't, their interest is looking after Elvis. Like, they don't really care about her. Like, they're going to make sure she has food and a place to sleep. But in terms of, like, her actually, like, her well-being, like, they're not interested in that. Like, his whole crew of boys, they didn't care about her either. Like, there's that one scene when Elvis is asking about his song and she was like, I don't know if it's good. And he literally throws a chair in her direction and they're just like, oh, look out. Like, what? They're acting like someone is like throwing a football and it might hit you. Like, oh, yeah. Let me get out the way. Like, he threw a chair at this woman. Like, are you? And then he's like, oh, you know, I have my mom's temper. And I'm like, it was hard for me to feel bad for this man. Cause like, even though, like you said, he was trying to find ways to, I don't know, connect to something else because everything in his life seemed very superficial. And I get it. Like, when you're a very successful person, everyone in the world wants you. You have all these opportunities, but you're also like constrained because you have a manager who's keeping you on a leash. Your father's in charge of all your finances. You can't do the roles that you really want to do because everyone just sees you as like, you know, a show pony. Like, they're not really interested in like what you have to think or, I mean, what you have to say or what you think. I get how you're like in a position where like, I just want to control whatever I can. And the thing that he could control was Priscilla, unfortunately.
Yeah.
Like, I get it. And again, it's like the 60s, like women were expected to just stay in their home and not do anything. But I guess from a 2023 lens and just being a woman, like, it was so frustrating the fact that like, he wouldn't even let her like have a job really. Like, he wouldn't let her do anything. Like, she was trapped in that house because he just wanted her to be there 24/7, even though he can go out and do whatever he wanted to do. She was still obligated to stay home and keep herself cute for whenever he decided to roll back up. Like, it was just the most frustrating. I can't tell you how frustrated I was. I was like, the nerve, the audacity of this man. Like,
yeah, she was his emotional crutch, and that's how it kind of played off of. And that scene in particular where he's listening to other artists, particularly, this is a known thing, Elvis jacked a lot of music at that time there from black artists, so they're listening to other artists to see who they can sample from or re-record for his projects. And even he himself, like, is, yo, these are all bad, they need to send me something good. And like you said, his friend is there as a yes man saying, no, but this is nice, this is nice, this is nice. And Priscilla has the same opinion as Elvis. That's why that scene got me the maddest at the most. Mm-hmm. Because she shared your opinion that what they're sending you is trash, and you lashed out at her for agreeing mm-hmm. with you. That's when you can see that that's like a real issue. And, you know, but then again, she joins him at a young age, at 14. And you should see her transition from like 14, 15 to like, Sophia says 30s, her 30s at the end of the film. Mm-hmm. So yeah, it's one of those things. And then she doesn't know who she is. Like, she skipped right past, you know, typical adolescence to an adult with no wherewithal of who she is or who her identity is. Like, the moment he's like, yeah, I'm gonna send you back to Germany with your parents, she breaks out and cries because she did not like being there at all. She doesn't know where to go or what to do or anything, you know, which leads her to the end of the movie when he's touring and stuff in Vegas. Like, yeah, I'm gonna stay in the house in LA. And mm-hmm. that's where she has her most growth, near the end of their relationship and the end of his career almost.
Yeah, and it's, I guess I didn't know, or I mean, I guess I like assumed, but you know, you don't really know for sure, like how abusive the relationship was. Like, the depths of how abusive it was. Because I think Lisa Marie, before she died, like, sent emails to Sofia Coppola being like, you're portraying my father in the wrong light. And I mean, listen, as the kid, like, you don't want to believe that your parents would do something like this, yeah. But that's Priscilla's life. Like, that's her experience. You know what yeah. I'm saying? Like, she lived that. So I don't know. But I feel like I think that it was good at how it uncovered or revealed what abuse looks like, because it really started off really tiny things. Like, he would say things to her, like when they were back in Germany, like, oh, just stay the way that you are now, you know, sweet, innocent, young. And then it would go to being like, oh, let me choose your clothes. Like, this color looks good on you. This color doesn't. Do something different with your hair. Do something different with your makeup.
A groomer.
Literally grooming. Literally groomed her. But the thing that I found, and he was also physically abusive to her too. The thing that I found crazy was how he was sexually abusive to her. Like, the fact that he, because when I heard the story about how they were like together and naked in bed, but they didn't have sex, I was like, that sounds like some BS. Like, that doesn't even sound real. But when I watched this, I was like, oh, like, he is withholding sex from her because out of like some control, like, mind yeah. game thing. Where I was like, whoa, that's twisted. Like, I didn't even, I didn't know how twisted that was until I saw that play out. I was like, oh, okay. So, like, that's probably the truth of that story that I heard from back in the day. Like, what? That, it's really, it was really messed up because he wasn't having sex with her, but he was cheating on her. Like, and then there was a moment where he admits it, where he's like, yeah, like, I did it, but, like, listen, you're the girl for me. I was like, oh, this man is sick. This is a sick, sick, twisted person, because he knows that she's young and that she is like dependent on him for everything. Like, he's isolated her from everyone else. And so he can really do whatever he wants with her. It's awful. It's awful. And she kind of has to accept the cheating just so he won't like force her to leave. I'm just like, this is the worst. Most toxic relationship. Like, nobody deserves to be in this position, and it's really bad because there are powerful men who do this same thing yeah. where they go after young women. We've talked about it. I won't call any names, but y'all know who we're talking about. Like,
yeah,
because they think, because they want the control, not because, I don't know if they're necessarily even attracted to young women other than like, I know that I can control this person because I'm powerful and rich, not realizing that they're going to get older and they're going to figure out who they are and have a mind of their own and leave or push back, like challenge you on stuff. It's like, it doesn't dawn on them. And then they get rid of them and get a new one. It's just get therapy. Like, I don't know.
The sad thing is, it's not even like rich dudes. Like, if you go on like Facebook or Instagram or TikTok, whatever your preferred social media platform is, you see plenty of these dudes, you know, your Andrew Tates of the world, your, you know, do people who like will randomly interview people on the street. Like, the amount of people I've seen online of random people interviewing couples, like, oh, this is your man, this is your girl, how long you know each other? And I've seen dudes vehemently say, oh, once you hear the age gap, like oh, she's 18, 19, early 20s, or and he's like, oh, I'm like 30, I'm like late 20s, so like 30s or whatever, that age gap. And the first thing out of their mouth is like, oh, you gotta get them young. Like, it's not even rich dudes, it's a bunch of sleazy broke ass dudes who are doing the same thing with this kind of mentality. And it sucks. And I think part of the issue, like I said, this is Priscilla's catharsis, or her release mm-hmm. of all that experience. Like, the book came out in 1985. Mm-hmm. And yes, I understand at the time before Lisa Marie passed away, like, you don't want to see your parents portrayed in a negative light, you know, much like how the Williams sisters and King Richard portrayed their father in a different light, because they showed their perspective of their father based on their time with him. They didn't showcase their other siblings' portrayal of their father because they don't mm-hmm. know that experience. So that kind of taints her, and she's saying she doesn't see her father's perspective of her father. Like, at the time when your parents like kind of separated, I think you were kind of too young to actually experience or acknowledge what your mother went through. Like, and that's the thing, a lot of abusive relationships or marriages, a lot of times, whether it's the man being abused by the wife or the wife being abused by the husband, they try to hide those things from the children. So I can see why she would feel a certain type of way about it. But yeah, this, and I think she fell for this trap. This is me putting my inference, is based on her relationship with her father in the beginning of the movie, where her father is like the strict military man, but he falls in the trap of, oh, you're mature for your age, and those kind of things. And it's due to the lack of, I think, substantial relationship with her father that she kind of falls into this plot hole. Oh, here's a younger, older man who's interested in me and what I have to say in the way I think. And that usually, they, like, psychologists stuff really do say the absence of your parental relationship with either party affects how you kind of do go into your adult relationships a lot. So.
Yeah. Yes, that is very true. I think it was that. I also think it's very, like, it was giving me so much of, like, Princess Di, like, young Princess Di. Yes. And Charles.
Yes.
It was giving me that, especially when he starts reading at her. I was like, oh my God, Charles, the same thing. Like, there's nothing more cringeworthy than having someone read at you a book that you don't care about. Like, but, just in the way of, like, you know, this person's already super famous. You know, it's not like she met Elvis when he was, like, coming up. Like, he was humongously famous and even more famous when he went back from the RV. And the idea that someone that important zeroes in on you, a very normal person, you know, you're not a famous actress or a famous singer. You're just, like, a normal schoolgirl. And that this person, this star, is giving you all of this attention and making you feel special. Who isn't going to fall for that? Especially when you're 14 years old. Like, you don't even, children can't consent to anything. Like, you have no, your brain is still developing, your body's still developing. Like, you're just not there yet. So of course it makes, and I mean, that's why he did it. Like, obviously. And also I think because of the fact that she wasn't, like, talking to anyone about it, there was a thing where, like, oh, well, I trust you because you're not going around and saying, oh, Elvis is my boyfriend. Like, you're keeping it to yourself, which means that you're trustworthy. And we have this, like, little secret with the, like, within ourselves. And it just breeds, like, a lifetime of keeping secrets. I mean, he was giving her drugs. Like, it. What? Just madness, man. Just absolute madness. And that's the thing. It's like, anybody can get kind of caught up with it, which is why I really look at, I'm looking at the parents, because I'm like, you, and maybe, I don't know, maybe parenting was different back in the day. I don't know how they operated back in those days where maybe these things were kind of normalized. I don't know. I mean, this is not the only situation where, like, there's been a child bride. Like, that's happened frequently in the past. I mean, I don't know if it still happens as much today, but. Well, at least, like, in high profile relationships, like, I'm sure it's going on other places. But I'm looking at the parents because I'm like, this is your kid. Like, you can't, you don't even know this man. Like, you don't know this man. You don't know his friends. You don't know these people. And they say that often. Like, they said that repeatedly. And yet somehow Priscilla was still living with him. Like, it was just, and still dating him before she left. Like, I don't know, like, the world is so crazy. Like, you really gotta protect these kids, like, because the predators are going to continue to predator. Like, I don't know what else to say. It made me really sick. Like, it made me, I was really sad for her. I was like,
yeah,
damn girl.
Yeah. I mean, and the thing is, I wasn't really a big Elvis fan, so I was already anticipating him to be a villain anyway. So this doesn't really taint my portrayal of him, and it just adds to, like, oh, okay, he was not a 100% dude that everybody thinks he is. But yeah, this movie is, like you hit the nail on the head. When I was watching this, I really got a lot of, like, Prince Charles, Diana parallels in it. And it's really, really sad. And I was also thinking, I was thinking about, oh, Sophia would probably do a really good Diana movie. You know,
no, I would see that. I'd watch
this,
that.
This is her wheelhouse. And I think you mentioned something earlier about Priscilla's personality not being portrayed as much. Because like you said, you're a big dialogue person. I'm more of a body language person when I watch these movies. And I was reading, I'm not sure, either is, I think it's Architectural Digest. Mm. And they were talking about how when Sophia does these movies, once again, these trapped princess pictures, almost kind of how in the style of how Wes Anderson is very hyper-detailed with people's, you know, colors and how their houses and rooms are decorated to give you a lot of insight into the character, which is typical. In this movie, like you said before, we don't see that of her in her bedroom. We see Elvis's bedroom. And I think that keys and that adds in the layer to the fact that she's trapped. Because usually in Sophia's movies, when you showcase these women's bedrooms, it's their personal sanctuary. Mm-hmm. It's where they're able to showcase their identity. But in this case, all we see is Elvis. The house is Elvis. You know, we see Elvis buy her a car. We don't ever see her driving it. We see her driving a different car. And, you know, she's constantly in Elvis's bedroom. There's nothing in there that showcases anything of her, which, you know, once again, speaks to the fact that, you know, at the time, as a 14-year-old child, Priscilla really had no self or identity developed at that time.
Yeah. It was very much, even though it's not, you're not like looking at it through his perspective, you can just see like how his world like just enveloped her. Like she was just completely consumed by his life. And one thing that I wasn't a huge fan of was the fact that the movie ends right after their divorce. Because I don't know, you spend so much time with her in relation to him. And I don't know, I kind of want what happens after that. Like, what does she go on to do? Like, what is her life post Elvis? Because she still has one, right? Yeah. So like, I was hoping that the movie would lean into that a little bit more, because we already kind of know about the relationship. And I kind of wanted to see like, okay, so how does someone who is trapped in this life for so many years, once they get liberated from that, what does their life look like afterwards? And we didn't get that. And I thought that was a little weird, because I just felt like, I don't know, I felt like there was more to be explored there. Like, who is she now? Now that she's found her identity, like, what does that Priscilla look like? And we don't actually know. So I thought that was a little bit of a misstep, because again, like, the Elvis movie just came out last year. So it was like, we've already been saturated with his life, his perspective, his thing. And honestly, I kind of think he's a hack. Like, the man is unoriginal. But like, I feel like I wanted more of her life post him.
Yeah.
And I don't know, maybe that was never like how the story was going to go, because the book is about her relationship and Elvis. Like, I guess that was the focus, was just focusing on that relationship. So I just wanted more.
I mean, I think that also might be due to the fact that I think we divorced in like the 1970s, and her as an individual, you know, like, she was also an actress as well. Like, her acting career doesn't pick up until like the 80s.
Mm-hmm.
So I can kind of see why they ended there, because she had not gone into the next phase of her life as a person. So it does kind of work, you know, the end of a Dolly Parton. Well,
That was a good needle drop. Love that needle drop. But I actually looked on her Wikipedia just to see like what happened after she got divorced from Elvis. And she apparently started like a fashion boutique that was like all the celebrities went to go visit. Like, she had her own thing going on. Like, even before like the acting stuff happened, she was still doing stuff. So it's not like her life just was like on pause, and then during the 80s it unpaused and she was like realized back to life. Like, I that's why I was just like, because you spend so much time with her in school and then with him and then the divorce, and then it's just like, okay, so where does Priscilla come back into this equation? Like, where is, like, who is she now? it kind of left me, it left me with more questions than answers. Maybe that was an intentional thing, but
I mean, what, they divorced in like 1973 or two, and then Elvis dies in 1977.
Mm-hmm.
I think it was appropriate. And I think where the ending ends is also due to the fact that that's probably, like, in the process of writing the book, she probably started writing this book when they divorced. And, you know, it didn't get published until 1985. So that probably might also be where she had ended writing the book, was at their divorce. So,
yeah, I guess
we're not. That's my only explanation for it. It's up to Priscilla Priscilla on set could have said, I want to include, you know, my stuff after. But I do think the core aspect of the story was that relationship she had. Because once again, everybody thought this was a fairy tale wedding, like young girl from the middle of nowhere, Austin, Texas at the time. It wasn't middle of nowhere, let's be honest. You know, falls in love and marries, you know, Elvis Presley, much like Diana and Charles, regular girl meets the prince. So, yeah, I do feel like she ended it there because it is very much a cautionary tale, you know.
So. Yeah, I guess I wanted a little bit more. But that's fine. And then in terms of, like, the music was great. Again, the Dolly Parton, I Will Always Love You, loved that. That was such a good way to kind of tie things up just in song. And I like that they didn't use too much of his music. They kind of just used other music that was going on around the time, which I thought was very smart. The montages of them being happy, I was just, like, so over that. Maybe because I was just over him. And I was like, yeah. I don't want to see this man anymore. Like... please get him off of my screen. There were like a couple of the montages of like, oh, look, things were happy for like a montage, and then things were terrible. So after a while, I was just like, can we get to the part where they leave, where she leaves? Like, I need us to get there. But yeah, I feel like towards the end, like I remember when I left the theater, I was like, okay. Like, I feel like I'm unpacking it now and I can feel all of the emotions that I was feeling at the time. But like when the movie ended, I was like, I felt flat. And I don't know what that means. But not that I didn't care about what was happening here, because I definitely did. I think I just, I don't know. I guess I didn't know how to feel. Mainly because it's like, you can't rewrite history. Like, that just is what happened. Like, they're in terms of like getting justice or whatever for her, like, he died, like, it's too late. And hopefully she found like the peace. I don't know, she's been going through a lot. Like, a lot of people in her family have been dying. Like, it's not good, but like, I hope she's okay now, because she's been going through a lot for the last couple of years. But in terms of like what happened before that, at post him and then pre all of this recent deaths, like, I hope she found peace because and healing, because that is really, that could really mess you up for like the rest of your life. Just having that experience.
You know, I think it said she didn't remarry, but she had like a 22-year relationship with a computer programmer. You know, of course she's Riley Cuff's grandmother. You know, Riley is Lisa Marie's daughter. So yeah, I think there was a period where she had peace, but then I remember when after Lisa Marie died, I think it was also during the filming of this movie, she said something, because I seen it personally. You'd like, as a parent, burying your kid is not, you know, something anybody should ever witness, and I've seen it happen in my family like twice. So that probably weighed a lot on her. And we, like, she hasn't really said anything post that. I know she like recently tweeted, which is funny. I love when like older celebrities like get a Twitter, and like your fan base is not the Twitter fan base. They're still stuck on Facebook falling for scams and stuff, and she's talking about how she's doing a performance, I think, in Las Vegas and stuff, and for people to come out and like saying thank you for everybody turning up to the premiere of the movie. But yeah, it looks like she's doing well. But yeah.
Yeah. Definitely a cautionary tale.
Moving on from Elvis. A lot of stuff has been happening over the last couple days in the film world. Of course, we had SAG-AFTRA, of course, and the AMTP delivered a message to SAG-AFTRA saying, this is your last, best, and final offer in regards to their strike. This is day 100. Well, as of recording, this would probably be day 117, if I'm correct. But yeah, and I think this strike is still honestly shorter than the writer's strike by a large margin. But yeah, basically the union said it's working to end the strike responsibility, but the two sides still have massive differences. There are several essential items which we still don't have an agreement on, including AI, and we'll keep everybody informed as events unfold. And because we're recording this on a Monday night, if you know things change over the following day, you'll probably see that on Twitter already as you're listening to this. But yeah, they said the negotiating committee spent nearly 12 hours on Saturday crafting their response. And I guess the AMTP said in a Zoom meeting that this current offer is the best it can do, and it's not going to negotiate further. Don't know what you're going to do, AMTP, when you're if you don't have actors, you know, especially considering that, you know, a judge has ruled that AI content cannot be copyrighted, and these actors are also not going to sign off their image and likeness unless you give them substantial money. So you're going to lose, and now also the film schedule, if this continues, is going to be pushed back to almost the next couple years. So I feel like the AMTV is fighting a real losing battle. These guys are really out of touch at the moment.
Yeah, I'm just like so over this. Like, I've never been more over anything else. Like, I just can't. I just feel like this thing is, for maybe because the writers already have a deal now. So yeah. I guess like everyone's assumption, and not just mine, but like everyone who was out there, I think from what I was reading, we're like, okay, the actor stuff is going to get wrapped up real quick. Like, we're going to be able to get this done in like 2 weeks. Maybe by the end of the month, it'll be done. And the fact that this is still dragging on, and it looks like, I think your prediction was actually right when you were like, this isn't ending until next year. Like, I feel like that is looking more and more like a reality, because and I guess my question is like, you guys are so far apart on really big issues. How much more negotiating is it going to take for you to get on the same page or even get close to the same page? It doesn't seem like, if you're this far apart at this juncture in the negotiations, like, where are we meeting at? Like, what's our meeting point? Like, I don't even know if that's even like a reality of like, we're going to be in a place where we can actually make a deal on this.
Yeah.
And I don't know how the actors are feeling about this. Like, there are some actors who like signed a letter last week being like, we would rather strike than like get a bad deal. And I'm like, I saw the names of the people who signed it, and I was like, okay, well, yeah, y'all have, again, the safety nets. Like, you're okay to wait it out. I don't know if any other like lower ranking or like other actors, background actors, also signed that letter. I'm not sure. But I don't, we're not in the negotiation room, so we don't actually know what's being discussed. The studios really were the biggest buttholes for taking that break and not negotiating for 2 weeks, like literally wasting your own time and burning through your own money, like stupid. Yeah. they're so dumb. But for this, I'm just like, y'all just got to make an agreement, like figure it out. Like, I cannot. The amount of space this is taking up in my brain, the fact that I'm just like, yo, the fact that we're not getting Stranger Things for like how many years? Like, they're going to be in their early or even mid 20s. The older actors are going to be closing in on 30 if they're not already there. Like, this is a mess. Like, this is an actual mess. And they're like, well, there are certain shows that are going to have to be canceled. And like, everything that was on the calendar for next year is getting pushed way back to 2025.
Which is weird, because also this week they've announced a lot of shows being renewed for like their next season. Like,
yeah. And
the key point with residuals is when shows hit their third season, that's when residuals kick in for the most part. Mm-hmm. And I'm seeing shows getting renewed for like season 4, season 5, season 6. Like Stranger Things is supposed to be season 5 right now. So you're announcing all these shows getting renewed without your actors. How does that work? And I know we spoke about this, like I mentioned it way in the beginning when we first started talking about this issue, like we've been talking about this thing for like almost six months. Like, yeah, from the writers to now, like how we've already seen instances of other production companies outside of the big ones, like your Disney, your Foxes, your Amazon, your CBS, those properties, be given allowances by SAG to continue shooting. Those big breadwinners, because especially like NBC, ABC, CBS, whose part of their earning is with TV, not just film. Well, ABC is Disney. They're going to be at a big detriment to all these other studios who are agreeing to what the actors want in interim. You're about to be phased out by out of nowhere. Like, I can see A24 taking up that spot that, you know, MGM and Paramount used to hold. Like, you're in danger from all these other smaller production companies saying, we agree with you. Like, actors are going to continue to shift over and work with them. Like, they're going to probably shift over and work with other streamers. If, you know, if Amazon and Netflix and Apple and Netflix don't agree, like Pluto TV, there's plenty of other streamers who will probably agree with actors because they can say, oh, you know, this is Tubi, this is, you know, Pluto TV, you know, we just got Brad Pitt on a contract to do one of our movies. How big that is for them? Like, people are gonna go download even the crappy streamers just to watch a new the Brad Pitt project. So it's weird, especially considering the only difference between the writers and actors is they both want fair pay, they both want residuals, they both want AI. Like, well, the only other sticking point the writers had was you must keep writers' rooms. Like, they both want the same things, but I think the issue is vehemently is that these major streamers in particular do not want to pay residuals at all. They don't want to release their data, which, like we said before, like all these streamers say, this is the best movie on Amazon, it's best movie on Netflix for like the week or the month, but we don't really get the data on it. So if that data comes out, that might send a sign to consumers and also investors that they're propping up fake numbers, and that might cost their bottom line and their stock numbers being affected if that becomes revealed. So I think that's probably why this is taking so long with the actors in particular.
Yeah, that's true. That is true. I totally believe that. If that's the reason, I buy it. They said this is their best and final offer, but I heard earlier that like they're like scheduling more negotiation. So I don't want to keep talking about this. Like, that's the thing. Like, I need this to be done. Like, the fact that it's been six months still.
I know. It's also funny, this comes out in the midst of Disney hiring a new chief financial officer. So,
a new CFO?
Yeah.
Not CEO. That's still Bob Iger, right?
Yeah.
Okay.
So.
Yeah. Darn. All right. Moving on to our next story. There's a crisis at Marvel. There is some issues going down there. I mean, the thing is that, like, there has always been issues. Like, if you've been on the internet, you know the discourse of what's been going on with Marvel. post Avengers Endgame, like, but particularly they're swapping their strategy because, as most of you know, Jonathan Majors was going to be like the face of their new phases, the big bad for the next couple of movies. They're chucking him out and they're trying to do something different with Dr. Doom.
Yeah.
They're trying to put that in place, which to me makes sense because, like, we don't know what's going to happen with that court case, but it's already uncomfortable. Like, as a person who's already, like, watching Loki season two, like, I don't like the fact that I keep seeing his face, even though I know that he is in the show. So, like, I guess to cover their own back, we gotta push him to the side, and that's on him. He did that. Allegedly. Don't sue me, allegedly. And then there's also issues with Mrs. Marvel? The Marvels?
The Marvels.
What is this
the
movie Marvels. Called? I'm not going to see it. because there were tons of reshoots. Like, I think there was like 4 reshoots. And I mean, the reshoots on like big movies aren't uncommon, but there was a lot of them. And also because of the comments that Nia DaCosta already made about like how Marvel works, I don't know how that's going to motivate anybody to go to the movie theaters and see this. Like, it costs like over 100-something million to make, maybe even more than that.
Yeah.
And what it's being projected to actually make at the box office is like $75-80 million, which is, and again, like, these big movies have to make like what, 2-3 times their budget in order to get like recoup. So mess over there. And then they, is Blade even happening? Like, the fact that they had to do so many rewrites and they was it shut down all of this before the writer strike happened. Like, I think Kevin Feige is like really understanding that, like, this is not going in a productive way. Like, this is kind of breaking down. And he's trying to restructure in a way where, like, we can keep the Marvel bus going. But I feel like, I don't know how much steam it has left. I think it's reaching its stopping point.
Yeah. It's funny, like, because I, like, last Friday this past, like, Kevin Feige had announced, like, from years ago at Comic-Con about Blade's release date. Blade's release date was November 3rd. And so if you go to the announcement, like, people are all retweeting it to, like, because they had, like you said, they had so many stuff, like, Mahershala Ali walked off at one point because of how bad everything was. You know, it's, like, they released the data, the numbers, like they said, the budget for, like, the first Avengers movie was on par with the entire budget for She-Hulk.
Wow.
She-Hulk, yes. And then they were saying, like, She-Hulk's visual effects, like, and it's mostly just her who needs the visual effects. They said a lot of those visual, like, not her. You remember Moon Knight?
Yeah.
The scene where he's first transforming into Moon Knight in the bathroom, where they do simple old Hollywood trick is the multiple mirror thing. Like, we've seen so many older pictures do it fine without the use of special effects. But they said that scene took them almost 6 months to edit because they had to remove the cameraman out of the shots. Are you telling me that fucking, like, are you telling me, like, directors like Kubrick, you know, fucking, like, Scorsese, Coppola, all these dudes from before were doing that same trick in other pictures without the use of, like, special effects or anything, and they had no issues? But you're telling me now, in like a 2022 with digital cameras and cinema and all that, it took you 6 months to remove a cameraman from a scene, and these guys were doing it in the 50s, 60s, 70s, 80s without the technology we have? That's a real big mismanagement of funds. If they figured that scene was going to be so extensive, shoot it one time of him looking back and forth, you take that shot into your 3D modeling program that they all use, and then just do the shot 3D and call it a day. Because they're already using 3D because he turns into Moon Knight, and that whole Moon Knight scene is just CGI. They could have just CGI'd all that, eliminated, spent taking an FX artist 6 months to remove it, which I'm all for FX artists getting paid, but but I'm looking at a budget. Like, that is really excessive. So, yeah, like, Marvel has a lot to recover. I think they got too cocky, too ambitious, way too soon. And that's the crux of their problems. Like, they're forcing you now to watch, like, three seasons of, or three different shows to know what's happening in the next movie. Like,
and I
that
won't.
Shouldn't be the case. And that never happened. That didn't happen before. Like, yeah, people were watching your Netflix stuff before, but because Marvel was like, it's on Netflix, it's not a part of the universe, and people were fine with that. I could watch, you know, street level heroes beat people up and not have to worry about aliens. If I want to see alien shit, I watch a movie. Or, you know, they mentioned Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. was in the same universe but didn't interact. Agency was on its own thing, not dealing with Avengers shit. Like, and it worked. And now you're forcing me, because of your contract with Disney, I have to watch everything on Disney Plus to know what's happening in the next project, which is really stupid. So
yeah, and nobody wants to do that. Like, if it becomes an obligation, yeah. It's like I have to do homework in order to watch. Nah, rather not. Just rather not. Like, that's not what entertainment really should be. I don't feel like that's what it should be. Like, you have to do a whole course lesson on, like, the last three phases in order to realize, like, what's happening in this one movie that's supposed to connect to, like, five other movies that aren't even coming out yet, not even made. Like, it's just, I understand what they were trying to do. I think in its initial kind of stages, it really worked. It was exciting. Like, I've went back and watched some of the older films, and I'm like, this was really good. Like, I liked how everything connected. It felt special. But I feel like once they took that transition to Disney Plus and was just, like, pumping out stuff, it lost whatever magic I think it had. Because it's like, you're just, like, tossing out stuff. Like, nah. Like, we don't want that.
and that's larger the issue. The issue is because Disney Plus at the time, Disney was just, you know, their Disney Channel stuff, you know, of course, whatever documentaries or musicals they play on, like, ABC certain times of the year. Disney really had no content for Disney Plus until, you know, they started saying, we need a lot of Star Wars stuff, we need a lot of Marvel stuff, you know, we got National Geographic. Disney really had no content for Disney Plus. I mean, they do now because they kind of sort of have bought Hulu. Hulu was FX, but it was still kind of on its own. But now they pay like $5 billion to get Hulu. But because Disney had no content, we were forced to be bombarded with nonstop Star Wars and Disney stuff in it, to its detriment. They really had no plan for what they were doing streaming-wise, just knowing that they're going to do a streaming platform and we have to catch up to Netflix number-wise. And the quickest way to do that, oh, what's our biggest box office draw at this time? Star Wars and Marvel. So,
yeah. Now I'm kind of like I think it's kind of cool that X-Men is coming back and we're hopefully getting that into the MCU. Maybe getting vampires and werewolves, like, to, like, them doing that stuff. But honestly, if it doesn't happen, like, I'm not gonna be sad. Like, that's kind of where I'm at with the MCU. I'm just like, if it happens, cool. If it doesn't, whatever.
And it's funny also, because you mentioned, like, you potentially getting X-Men, which is funny. Like, the whole Marvel universe that we see right now at Disney, when in the 90s, when Marvel was broke, you know, they sold their rights. They saw Blade being made into a movie that was a success. They saw Spider-Man become a movie that was a success. They saw X-Men become a movie that was a success. And they're like, oh, we sold all our major popular IPs. What do we have left? We have Captain America, we have Iron Man. They weren't popular comic book characters at those times. They only became popular recently because of the movies. But even if you look at it numbers-wise, for Marvel's bread and butter is still the comic books. X-Men comics still outsell these Avengers characters, which is also why they're trying to force the cinematic version. Like, Marvel does this whole multiverse thing where the same world that's in the comics is a world which is in the movies, which doesn't make sense, because they still see that no matter how hard they tried, the IP they didn't own for a long time, as, you know, X-Men, is still outselling their current star characters, which are still fine funny.
Yeah, so we'll see what happens with that. Okay, so let's talk about what we've been watching, Dale.
I've watched two things the last couple days. First one, I watched Elemental. Oh my gosh, I loved Elemental. I felt really, really like look, I make fun of my dad a lot because as a kid growing up, my dad worked nights. So he would watch me in the morning as a kid. So my dad used to like, the only media on is like soap operas. So to this day, I make fun of my dad for watching soap operas. But then I was like, I was watching Elemental and I was like, oh my gosh, I'm my father's child because this movie is so sappy and I'm engrossed in it. Like, I love, like, it's a story of like, her first generation immigrant kids, and that's my shit. I vibe with it because I know that experience, mm-hmm. you know. And I loved it so much. I love what Marvel, like, I love what Disney's doing by getting other people's experiences in their project. They're getting a more diverse directors, writers, and creatives to tell their stories. I love that so much. And I also watched another animated property, called Scavenger's Reign. Once again, Guillermo del Toro. Animation is a medium, not a genre. You could do kids movies, adult movies, whatever. Scavenger's Reign is an adult movie on adult cartoon on I'm still calling it HBO Max. It's HBO Max still to me, but it's a really beautiful sci-fi show dealing with people lost on a planet, marooned, and trying to find their way. It's not heavy on the sci-fi. But it's really beautiful and surreal. And it's like, I can't put into words and describe what I'm watching currently still, but it's a beautiful show. Like visually, even though it's animated, it is like, it's very much to me, like watching a Studio Ghibli picture, but it's very lovely. I recommend anybody, to watch that project.
Hey. Yes, so I watched Certain Women and I was so excited to watch Certain Women because I've been wanting to watch this for so long. Especially after like watching Killers of the Flower Moon, like just remembering that like Lily Gladstone is in this movie. I never got a chance to watch it, but like I was, and that's like why she got picked for that movie or cast for that movie rather. Yeah, so this movie is by Kelly Reichardt, who's like an incredible indie film director. I watched her film Night Moves like years ago. But yeah, I've really been wanting to watch this one because it has Laura Dern is in it, Michelle Williams, Lily Gladstone, and Kristen Stewart. Like, and I'm a Laura Dern stan, so I was very excited for this. It feels like it was shot in like 2002, but it came out in 2015 or 16, one of those two. But like how she shot it, like was, it felt like there were, you can see like the grain, like I'm pretty sure they shot in film, but like it felt very naturalistic, which I think is like a part of how she, that's just like her stylistic choice of how she makes her movies. But yeah, it's like, a couple, it's like three separate stories that kind of weave together, but not like as tightly woven together as you might expect. And it's very like human, and there is a lot of dialogue where there needs to be, and then the dialogue is kind of scarce in moments where it also needs to be, like where you're just like reading people's faces and emotions. That's some of the most powerful stuff, especially with the Lily Gladstone. Again, going back to what we were saying the other week about like how she doesn't even need to like say much, like it's all there. Yeah. That's basically the same thing that happened with this. Like just great acting, great performances. I don't know. And the stories are just like, they're kind of random, but like you're invested because you're trying to wait to see like what actually happens with these people. And I think that it's, that's just really good storytelling. Like that's just good because as the audience, like you're really hooked on like wanting to know what is going to happen to these people, and the stakes don't feel that high, but you still feel that pull to like be invested in what's happening on screen. So great movie. I'm so happy I was able to watch it. Now I just gotta watch First Cow and that'll be good. Oh, and she made another film called Showing Up. I'll watch that too whenever that comes on somewhere. But yeah, she's such a cool filmmaker. I know people who are like into film know who she is. I don't think people outside of that really do know who she is. I don't know if she'll make anything like slightly bigger than the things that she's made so far, or she'll just kind of stay in this space, but very excited to see what she does next. So, yeah. Yep, and that is all for us today. We hope that you're taking care of yourselves and doing well. Make sure to check out all of our social media. Support us if you can, and we will see you guys in the next episode. Goodbye.
Au revoir.